This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1035, a conversation with J.M. DeMatteis. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1035. It's another conversation with J.M. DeMatteis. I was very lucky to be able to sit down with J.M. to talk about, in particular, the last couple years' worth of output that he's been putting out there. If you want to check out the previous interviews that I did with J.M., there are, thankfully, two of them that you can go back to that had previous episodes with him. The first one was episode 364, way back from 2016, April 14, 2016 is when it went live, so hard to believe that was 8 years ago. And then 6 years later, in February 2022, I sat down with him again. So we were talking about his current work at the time on Ben Reilly's Spider-Man. So on this one, we talk about, Ben Reilly's Spider-Man. We talk about Spider-Man Lost Hunt. We talk about the new book, Spider-Man Shadow of the Green Goblin, although I think I incorrectly call it Shadow of the Goblin a couple times. We also talk about his work writing the Chameleon during Pursuit back in 1994, I believe that is. We also talk about what it was, you know, leaving Spectacular and then jumping on Amazing back in the 90s. We also talk about writing Spectacular Spider-Man post-Clone Saga in a period which I think is criminally undervalued and underrepresented in trade paperback collections and any kind of discourse. I kind of grew up with Spider-Man in that period. My first regular issue of Amazing Spider-Man was issue, 419, which would have been the first post-Clone Saga Amazing Spider-Man issue with Tom DeFalco and Steve Scrooge. So that is a period I hold near and dear to my heart, kind of the post-Clone Saga pre-relaunch period, but it is not often talked about, so I definitely wanted to bring it up with J.M., and we also talk about one of my favorite issues of Amazing Spider-Man, 396, which would have been Back from the Edge Part 2, which was actually just something we talked about recently on our Book of the Month Club for March 2024, as we talked about Back from the Edge and The Exile Returns from the Clone Saga, as well as Power and Responsibility, the arc that kind of started it all. So you should definitely check those out. Upcoming episodes include, we have Ariana Marr on an episode. She's a letterer through Virtual Calligraphy, which is Chris Eliopoulos's kind of lettering studio. So that actually was a great conversation. It was really fun. Interesting to hear kind of her touch points in which comics meant a lot to her growing up. And she refers to the Age of Apocalypse as her Star Wars, and I completely get that. So I was very excited to talk with her. It was a lot of fun, great conversation. Upcoming episodes I have not yet recorded, and I'm supposed to be sitting down with Joe Rubenstein soon, acclaimed inker. Very excited about that. That should be in a couple days, so that'll come up in a few weeks. At the end of April, we'll have another Book of the Month Club, which should be talking about Web of Life and Web of Death and Smoke and Mirrors from the Clone Saga period, which is kind of the next 3 months after the first 3 months we did on the last episode of the Clone Saga, kind of retrospective, so to speak. And then we also have an upcoming episode with... maybe we'll keep that secret for now. And then returning guests, I think in May or June, we're going to have Ron Frenz back on. I feel like I got to parse it out because I would have him on every day if I could. I love talking to Ron. He's so much fun and always has really great insights about his art. And I've kind of put out to him that, you know, we should talk about something of his choice and, you know, do a creator commentary on something that he wants to talk about as opposed to just something that I bring to the table. I'm curious what he would like to revisit. So we'll see how that goes. And then we have some other stuff that's in the hopper working on for May and June. So hopefully we'll have some good stuff coming up soon. Anyways, thank you for listening to me ramble on. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and also listen to us on Spotify. And without further ado, let's jump right into the conversation with JMD talking about the last couple of years and the amazing output he's put in put out through that period. Some really different types of stories, but introspective as always. And yeah, he's just a great writer, and he really knows how to speak, and he's just a storyteller, and he's really fascinating. So he really, it doesn't matter if he's talking to you, or if he's writing a prose, or if he's writing a comic, he's just a good storyteller. And that's what you're going to get from JMD today. So enjoy.
JM, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I am great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. This is your third time joining us. The last time was just over 2 years ago, back in February 2022. We were also young and naive back then.
I was much younger, yes. I don't think I'd actually hit puberty then. And now since then, I've gone through puberty. I'm a very different person.
That's great. So what's interesting to me, so you've been very busy the last couple of years, like even just in the last two, you know, you had your work on Ben Reilly's Spider-Man, which I think was just ongoing as we were talking. Obviously, you've had your own creator-owned projects that have been happening. And then also you've had a variety of these, you know, kind of nostalgia-fueled Marvel miniseries that have happened. You had Spider-Man The Lost Hunt.
Right.
You had Magneto.
Yep.
You have the new one that just launched, Spider-Man Shadow of the Goblin. So it seems like you've been keeping pretty busy.
Yeah, very, very busy. You know, along with that, I put out in the past couple of years two novellas, which I'm always happy to talk about. One is called The Witness. The other is called The Excavator. They're both available on Amazon. I'm working on a third novella right now. Right. We're wrapping up the Demultiverse. Working on an animation project right now that I can't talk about, but I think you'd be very excited if I could tell you. And what else? Oh, and I have the new Batman miniseries for DC that'll be out in July.
That's right. So what keeps you fueled? Like, what keeps you so hungry that you're still, you know, moving ahead with all these projects? Like, you're not slowing down. You're just getting busier.
I was just talking about this the other day. The reality is I'd be doing, if no one was paying me and no one was publishing this stuff, I would be doing it anyway. You know what I mean? It's in my nature. I'm a storyteller. And I would be, you know, whether I was a professional or not, I would be laying in bed, you know, I watch movies in my head and I go, that's an interesting story. What's that? And, oh, I got to write that down. You know, it's just who I am. And so luckily people still like my work and want to pay me and hire me. And so not only do I get to dream these things, I actually get to get them out in the world, which is always wonderful. And right now I'm really, really busy. And the truth is, the truth of the freelancer's life is, you always have to ride the wave when it comes in, because I've seen over 40 plus years of doing this. The wave comes in, the wave goes out. It doesn't matter how, you know, unless you're in that rarefied air of those people that are so extraordinarily successful that nothing can touch them. But for the rest of us, you know, a career is up and down. And there are periods when you're really, really busy. And there are periods when work is just sort of like a desert, you know? Mm. So when the wave does come in, you got to get your surfboard and jump on. And if it's, you know, if everybody's calling right now, this is when you do the work, because in 6 months they might not be calling. And I know it sounds funny to say that after all these years of doing this and having had great success doing it, but that is the truth of the freelance life.
For sure. Now, a question I don't think I've asked you before, or if I have, forgive me for asking it again, given your history and past with music and how, you know, big music was in your life.
Yeah.
How does it play a part in your writing? Like, are you listening to something while you're writing? Does it help inform your writing? Do you kind of perform in solitude and in silence? Like, how best do you interact with that creative part of your brain?
That's a great question. Support? And the answers are going to sound contradictory. When I'm writing, for the most part, I can't listen to, well, it's not that I can't listen to music. There's only certain music I can listen to. It's usually sort of ambient / new agey, spacey background music. Mm-hmm. Anything that's like with definitive melodies and lyrics and whatever, my favorite music in the world, I cannot listen to it while I'm working. I just can't. It distracts me. So, you know, I you know, you hear about writers who, like, you know, they crank up the Springsteen and let's write. You know, I can't do that. Occasionally, to get in a mood, I might be listening to a soundtrack, you know, to take an obvious thing. You're writing a Superman story, so you put on John Williams' Superman soundtrack. But even that, after a certain point, it's like I get so locked into the story that I can't be distracted, whereas this sort of easy, floaty background music doesn't intrude and kind of creates a nice little bed around me. But that's as far as I can go listening to music. The flip side is, being a musician, I see writing musically. And I was just talking about this to somebody the other day. You know, writing in general and comics in particular, to me, is a very musical form. We first of all, we write in these little boxes, right? Each caption in these little boxes. That's how we tell the story. It crosses a line into sort of, even if it's not rhyming, it feels like poetry because you're writing song lyrics. You're writing with a certain rhythm, with a certain pace. One caption leads into the next. You're playing off the visuals. And then the captions have to flow and create in a certain way that they lead you to the next page. There's a flow, there's a melody, there's a drum beat. You know, it's almost like on one level, you know, there's one thing happening over here. There's a bass line going over there. There's a guitar part going over there. So I see it all that way when I'm working because it really is, especially in comics, it's a very rhythmic, melodic process. It's not like a piece of prose where, obviously in prose, you know, you can choose to be very rhythmic and poetic and all that. But with comics, because the pictures are in these little squares, the captions are then in their own little things, they have to move across the page a certain way and hook you to the next thing. It's very much like a song to me. That's the way if I don't see it that way, I feel it that way. Does that make any sense?
No, absolutely, it does. So I'm curious, when you're switching from writing for comics and then, you know, writing your novellas, is that an easy switch for you to switch from something that is more dependent upon a visual in your head? Not that novellas aren't in the same way, but it's, you know, there's going to be a visual component and you know it's going to be, you know, kind of this adjustment depending on the art that comes in. And as you said, kind of right. Writing through panel these panel boxes and then changing that form, do you find you actually have to kind of like walk yourself out of whatever you were just doing and going into the new format? Or is it easy for you to slip back and forth?
No, you know, I guess I've been switching around long enough. And actually, you know, when I did the first novella about 2 years ago, 2-3 years ago, I hadn't done any serious prose since my novel Imaginalis came out in 2010. So it took a little while for me to get back in the rhythm. It's like certain muscles that you've worked, it's like, oh, I still have these muscles, but I haven't worked them in 10 years. So you got to get it. It's like going to the gym and you start working those muscles. And, oh, yeah, now I got it. And then by the time I got to the second one, it was like, all right, this is easy. I can just get right back into this. But the difference is, well, first of all, on one level, there's no difference. You know, story is story is story, and you want to tell a great story. And a great story is a great story regardless of the format. But the form does dictate the way you tell the story. And in prose, there's a lot of room, you know. I mean, there's really no limit. It's whatever, you know. I'm still very visual. I'm seeing movies in my head all the time. That's just the way I write. I'm very, very visual. And, you know, I'm so dense that I only figured out a couple of years ago. You know, when I was a kid, my first love was art. I spent my entire childhood into my teenage years just drawing. And finally, all these years later, I figured out, oh, I am. So I guess I was always very visual, and that having that visual sense really helped me in comics. I never really, it sounds stupid, but I never made the conscious connection between being that kid constantly drawing and the fact that I can work in comics and TV with this visual sense that I have. But so in prose, I'm still seeing visuals. I'm still a visual writer. But, you know, the kind of the comics are a very specific form. TV, movies are a very specific form. With prose, you're creating the form as you're writing. You know, how long do you want your story to be? What style do you want to tell it in? I mean, there's really nothing to constrain you. And on one level, that's great. On the other level, that means there's even more choices to make about the telling of the story. You know, comics, I so know like the back of my hand. I don't even have to think about it when I'm writing a comic book story. You know what I mean? When you're first learning, you know, I remember when I first was in comics and really learning the form. The format is like it, very much in your conscious mind. The same with TV. The first time I was writing TV or film, you know, the screenplay format, you're thinking about the format all the time. And then you reach a point where it all goes from the conscious to the unconscious and it just becomes intuitive. And it's the same thing with prose too. And once it gets intuitive, you can just move between these different forms and slide back and forth. The only problem comes if you stay away from one form for too long. Mm. You know, I'm working on an animation thing now, and I haven't done an animation in a couple of years. And, you know, it took my brain a day to kind of, oh, okay, I remember these muscles, and my unconscious to go, oh, yeah, I can do this, click, and then off we went. But it took a little bit to reintegrate myself with that particular format because I hadn't done it in a couple of years.
it is interesting. I was going to ask about animation because obviously it feels like a close sibling of comic book writing because it is such a visual medium in a similar sense, right? Like,
yet it's very different.
Yeah, it's very fascinating because it's an interesting kind of bridge between kind of typical live action movies, as you would say, and then animation. It's again, it's a closer brother, but it's still separate.
Right. You know, and one level, you know, so much of what I've done has been with Warner Brothers dealing with the DC characters. So it is on one level an extension of that. But again, it's a very different form and you tell a story in a very different way. The wonderful thing about comics is it can be anything. You know, there's the old line people used to say, comics are movies on paper. Well, my answer is they can be that, but they can be anything else. I've always been fascinated between the line between comics, as I said, and poetry, comics and song lyrics, comics and prose. You know, if you read my stuff, you know, it's often very prose centric. Mm-hmm. And I remember years ago when Moonshadow first came out, which really kind of liberated me as a writer. And it was very, very much almost like an illustrated novel in a lot of ways, although there was plenty of pure comics work in there also. And I remember someone, an artist that I knew and respected who read it and went, well, that was really great, but it's not a comic book. Mm. You know, the answer to that is, what's a comic book? A comic book is any combination of words and pictures that we choose to put together in any way. You know, it may not be a, quote, Marvel comic or a DC comic or whatever, but it's still a comic book. And that's the beauty of comics. I mean, there is within that, you know, there's a certain limitation, sure, of the page and the space and a certain way to tell that story. But within that, there are dozens of ways to tell a story on the comic book page.
So I want to talk about some of your more recent work with Marvel in particular, because as I kind of mentioned, they have definitely slid into this kind of comfortable niche of creating these more, I call them nostalgia projects, but that sounds very like a derogatory term. But they do these things that are kind of set in, you know, a different time and continuity, and people kind of surf in and out of, you know, which kind of projects they want to do. I'm curious for you, because now I can't remember the exact answer. When Ben Reilly's Spider-Man kind of came up, what was that conversation like? Because obviously you're very much entrenched in that period. You did a lot of great work with Ben Reilly as a character, and obviously you've now done further Spider-Man miniseries. But I'm curious again about that first one, what that conversation was like about revisiting Ben.
You know, the funny thing is the conversation was like, I heard two words, Ben Reilly. The answer was yes. That was simple, because I love that character. I loved writing Ben. You know, I love Peter. You know, Peter, I was saying to somebody the other day in an interview that, you know, Peter is not just a character to me. Peter's like an old and dear friend because I know him so well after all these years. And the same with Ben, you know, working on the Lost Years, Redemption, the Ben stories that I've done. I really, really have a real resonance with that character. And I've always said for years, I'd write Ben Reilly again in a heartbeat. So when Danny Kazin, my editor, called me up and I heard the words Ben Reilly, I didn't have to think about it. It was a yes. It was an instant yes.
How quickly did you know, and I guess this is spoilers for a series from a couple of years ago, but how quickly did you know that you were going to use Spider-Side, who's more or less forgotten, unfortunately, but there's a lot of potential in that character, and you definitely mind. I mean, obviously, it goes to the whole idea of Ben and who is he and what is he, and at least at the time that your story is told, he thinks he's the, you know, the real Peter Parker, but then being confronted with someone who's, again, another failed clone. So was it like right from the beginning you knew that Spider-Side had to be part of this?
Yeah, I did, and I'll tell you why. And the reason is I never liked that character. You know, it was one of those, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on in the Clone Saga, and a lot of stuff was getting thrown against the wall. They were great stories, they were not so great stories, you know, it was a big mixture. I think overall there was a lot of great stuff that came out of the Clone Saga, and it's interesting to see, you know, it sort of got pushed, buried by Marvel for a while, and then over the years all these elements have come back, you know. But I never connected, clicked with, or really understood Spider-Side. And so one of the challenges for me is like, let's take that character that I really didn't like or connect with and see if I can make him into a very interesting and formidable adversary for Ben. And that was really, really fun. And by the, you know, that's the great thing. I always say there are no bad characters. You can take any character, and if you dig deep enough, if you find the right take, and for me, the right take is all about digging into their heads, you can make any character a great character. And that was the challenge with Spider-Side. And it wasn't that, you know, because I think the problem back then was there was just so much going on. There was never room to ever develop that character in any deep way back then. This miniseries gave me the room and the space to really, really dig in and develop him.
Although I've spoiled the reveal of Spider-Side, I will say that like the way that you built up to it when having these other villains, but it's really all Spider-Side, was a really smart move. Like, I'm really, and just, I did not see it coming because, you know, why would you think it's not Scorpion who shows up? You know,
right, and so right, right.
I thought that was really clever, and it makes sense when you read it back. And you're like, oh, the clues were there, but you weren't putting it together yet.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked, you know, because sometimes you come up, oh, that'll be a cool idea, and then it just doesn't work, or everybody figures it out on page two, you know. So I'm glad that it worked. Yeah, that was a really fun series, A, because just the simple joy of being reunited with Ben, which is, I always say, it's like you have an old friend that you haven't seen in 10 years, and you go out to lunch, you know, how you been, what's going on, what's changed. And so it really was like a reunion, and working with Danny, my editor, he's just a wonderful guy, really made the whole process delightful. And then he brought David Baldy onto that project, and I was unfamiliar with David's work up to that point and became a massive fan instantly. He's so talented and such a good storyteller. His work has such energy and humanity. He ended up working with me on one of the projects on my DeMultiverse Kickstarter, a book called Any Man. So the whole project was really a delight.
Now, I'm curious, and I think I've asked you this before, but I guess you kind of said it was all thanks to your editor, so thanks to Danny. But the aesthetics behind the packaging of Spider-Man Lost Hunt and Ben Reilly Spider-Man, in terms of the use of the logos, the use of the little spider icon that was back, that was in use back in the mid-90s. So that was all Danny kind of bringing that
stuff
together?
Yeah, he really loves that era. You know, that was his era, I guess, growing up. And he knows it, I'm sure, in many ways better than I do. Even the current series that just came out, you know, we're dealing with this character, the Proto Goblin, because it's the early days of Spider-Man, early days of Norman and Harry and Gwen. And I had no clue. I don't think I ever saw that story. If I did, I'd completely forgotten it. And he was the one who thought that we could bring this character in and it would work. And it does very well within the context of the story we're telling now. But that's, you know, that's the advantage of him being so deeply familiar with that era, in some ways even more than I am, despite the fact that I was in the middle of it writing those stories.
I'm curious, about Proto Goblin, because that was kind of an interesting, like, I knew who that character was. I remember Peter Parker, Spider-Man -1, but I didn't think anyone else did, so obviously Danny did. Did you call up Howard Mackey and be like, I'm using your character? And he probably said, who?
Yeah, I know I didn't call him up, but I'm sure he would have just said, who? because that's what I said, who? And he said, here's the issue. Go read it and you'll see it. And because we're dealing with the Osborne family and Norman before he officially becomes the Green Goblin, it was a perfect character to bring in. The Shadow of the Green Goblin, it's really fun because it's literally takes place a month after Uncle Ben's death. And I really, you know, I've written a few little stories that appeared in some Spidey anthologies around that time. And what fascinates me about that time is, he's just become Spider-Man. He's 15 years old. You know, think about yourself at 15 years old. Put yourself in, you know, when you're a kid reading Spider-Man, even though, oh, he's a teenager, he's a man to you as a kid, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you really think about it, unless you're 15, 15 is so young and uncooked and untried. And how overwhelming is that? I don't care if you gave me all the powers in the world, I would still continually screw everything up when I was 15. I would screw it up now, let alone when I was 15. You know, so it's been great to kind of look at that Peter, as opposed to the older, more mature Peter that I'm used to. And then, of course, all those relationships. You know, I love the Osborne family because they're so screwed up and dysfunctional. So it was great to go return to that. And we really dig deeper into Norman's marriage and Harry's mom and a whole element there, which I think gets revealed at the end of the first issue. I don't want to say anything, but if you've read the first issue, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And Gwen, we get to get Gwen in there, and it was just and Peter and Aunt May are, Uncle Ben is, you know, just died. It's like, you know, someone you love that was part of your family like that has only died a month ago. Mm-hmm. You're still in shock, and the two of them, by their nature, as we explore in the first issue, Aunt May is of the nature to just sort of push it down and push it away, even though she's in agony inside, and she's kind of doing it for Peter's sake. And Peter being Peter is all like, I'll make jokes and keep things light, and I don't want to upset Aunt May. So neither one of them is talking about what's really going on inside them beneath the surface and this tremendous grief that they're carrying, not to mention for Peter, the tremendous guilt. So it's really, really interesting to play with the two of them. Aunt May is a character that I always loved. I always say, you know, when I was a Spider-Man reader, I had very little patience for Aunt May. I just, oh God, this lady really, she annoys me. What the fascinating thing that happens is then suddenly you start to write a character and you understand them in a way that you never understood them as a reader. And I platonically fell in love with Aunt May. It wasn't a romantic entanglement. It was a platonic love. But she's a wonderful character and she has great, great depth to her. You know, you have to dig to find it, but it's all there. It's all there. And Peter grew so much and gained so much for her having been in his life.
It's interesting hearing you talk about it because it makes a lot of sense that, you know, when we see the original kind of Stanley issues, we see Peter kind of always worrying about Aunt May, but we don't really get into her head as much, just more, you know, her always being worried about Peter, but that's about it, and not really going the extra mile. But so your psychological examination of them, which is again very in keeping with what I think people come to expect from a JMD production, is that there's going to be a little bit more going on under the hood, so to speak. It is hard to read because you see these people in pain, you understand it, and it kind of recontextualizes those earlier Stanley issues.
Yeah, there's a big theme in this story, which I guess you can find in a lot of my stories of parents and children. Whether, you know, Uncle Ben and Aunt May might as well be Peter's parents, especially in this context. There's Harry and his dad and his mom who died when he was a year old. There's Gwen and her dad and her mom who's dying in the course of this story since she's in the hospital. She's got cancer. So there's a lot of grief. There's a lot of parents and children. But, you know, there's also Peter having fun as Spider-Man. And in fact, we see it's a great way to avoid dealing with all the issues in his life and the grief in his life. And there's some humor in there, too. As I think the birthday scene in the first issue worked out pretty nicely.
That's right. You bring up an interesting thing just in casually talking about it, because I think as a Spider-Man reader, you kind of go past it, but it's almost like, why did Stan make him already an orphan and then take away a father figure? Like, it's almost adding, you know, extra layers of crap on this person that maybe they didn't need it. Like, it's an interesting choice as opposed to just having his regular parents and then losing his father. Because as you said, Aunt May and Uncle Ben are essentially his parents and he kind of treats them and acts like they are. So it's an interesting extra level that Stan went to him. And I'm obviously he's not around to ask, but I'm just curious, like, what was he thinking as to why add that extra level of tragedy to a character like that?
Right. I'm sure if Stan was here, he would be able to make up a really great answer for that question, even if he couldn't remember. But, you know, it is interesting. I, as you're saying that, I'd never thought about that. You know, the whole backstory on Spider-Man is it started with this Simon Kirby idea for a character of Spider-Man. And that character was being raised by his aunt and uncle. So that element obviously got ported in from the Jack Kirby version that Kirby and Simon had developed years before. And then I wonder, you know, did Stan come up with the tragedy, or is that something Ditko came up with? It feels very Ditko in a lot of ways, you know, that darkness, that tragedy of Uncle Ben's murder, and that being the thing that really propels him into being Spider-Man. You know, you never know with that old Marvel stuff how much came from who. You know, I recently was just, you know, as we often do, going down a rabbit hole on Google and finding these old, they weren't interviews, but Ditko had written a lot of statements about his involvement in Spider-Man. And even from the very beginning, a lot of the elements in that story, you know, Stan was leaning, he wanted to do science fiction stories with aliens and this and that. And it was Ditko who was always fighting to really keep that character as grounded in the real world as possible. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the murder of Uncle Ben came from Ditko. You know, but right. What, you know, so it's a double loss. And I explored that in a story in Spectacular Spider-Man called The Child Within, where I dealt with something I'd never seen dealt with. How does a kid feel when both his parents die? You know, Peter was little, but he was aware and he knew that his parents had died. And it was never, ever, ever mentioned. you know, and so the seeds of so much else that happened in his life began in that moment with this little kid who was probably, I don't know, 4 years old when his parents died. So there's layers on layers there. And it's interesting. I never thought about it in the bigger way. Yeah, right. You have this character. He's already an orphan. And then you kill his uncle. But that does happen in people's lives. Horrible things like that. It's so funny. Being a Beatle person, the first thing that pops into my head is John Lennon, basically abandoned by his mother and father, raised by his aunt and uncle. When he's 14, his uncle dies. It's kind of Spider-Man, you know, and, you know, with great power comes great guitar work, I guess, you know.
So one thing about Shadow of the Green Goblin that really struck me and is that I've never heard of, was it Michael Stamaria?
Yeah, someone said, and I think they're probably right, that I think the STA is like for St. Maria, you know, that may be what the last name is. I can't swear to it, but I think that might be what it is.
Well, their artwork is absolutely incredible. Like, just because I don't know their art doesn't mean they haven't done a lot, obviously.
I didn't either. Danny found them. And, you know, it's I've been doing this a long time, and there are lots of artists that I've worked with over the years who are favorites of mine that I want to work with, excuse me, again and again and again. But it's always great to work with someone new, you know, to have that energy of someone new that you've never worked with before that has a different style. And he's new and he's very, very open. You know, if a page comes in and it's like, well, this doesn't quite work. Could you adjust that? Could you do this? And he does. And the work is beautiful. The coloring on that first issue is also very beautiful. He did a great job with the color. You know, it's important to always remember that every element in a comic book story is important. You know, it's not just the main writer and the main artist. It's the coloring and it's the lettering and it's the right editor. It's all those pieces have to come together to make a really good comic book story. And sometimes the reader doesn't realize it, but if one element is off, as a writer, I'm very sensitive to lettering. Mm-hmm. And I know that crappy lettering takes my story and drags it down because that's the delivery system for my story. That's what's going into your eyes and into your head. And if the lettering looks off, the story feels off. The same story you give it to a really good letterer, it's going to read better. And the experience of reading that story is going to be better. Now, it's an unconscious thing that happens. Most people don't think about it and they shouldn't be thinking about it. But for me as a writer, that's really, really important. Just as the coloring brings out so much in the artwork. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you say that. Because I was speaking to a letterer the other day who's part of the virtual calligraphy group, and they were saying the same thing. Like, you know, people won't necessarily know good lettering, but they'll know bad lettering, and mm-hmm. that will stick out like a sore thumb. And that and at times it's kind of a thankless job, but they know that if they're doing their job right, no one notices, which is heartbreaking, but because they're putting so much effort into it. But that's, you know, as you said, it's this unconscious thing that you almost can't unless you're, you know, and you're. In your angle, obviously, it's different because you're actually seeing your words come out and you can notice it very differently. But
yes.
A lot of readers, they're not going to notice. And so it's actually been interesting for me as a journey as a fan and as someone who talks to creators now that, you know, I've spoken to people like Richard Starkings, and he's really opened my eyes to the real beauty and the art of lettering in a way I didn't really respect or properly enjoy before.
Yeah, it is. It's an art. They're artists. They very much are artists. And I have so much respect for letterers. Well, for the good letterers, you know. And, you know, I have to have respect for them all because it's, you know, it's all this is hard work. You know, even and, you know, the truth of the matter is the letterer that I may think is like, oh, I don't want that person lettering my story. Someone else might think this is the best letterer. I want them lettering my story. So it's all personal taste in the end. But I know there are letterers that I know if these guys are lettering my story, I can take a deep breath and relax because it's gonna be great.
One thing I really loved about this first issue of Shadow of the Goblin is and something that we don't often see explored as much, and because it's Peter, you know, in that first month or two, you get to do it, is him being actually scared of himself and scared of his strength and learning to pull his punches. And that's something, again, I feel like usually we just kind of go along with it and we don't really think about it. And it's not something that's usually addressed. So seeing young Peter realizing and being almost horrified by himself that, you know, oh, I could have killed someone, is really an interesting exploration of the character. And again, shows the greenness that you're talking about, the fact that he is this brand new, and what would a 15-year-old be thinking about as he's starting to fight crime?
Yeah, I mean, if tomorrow you had Superman's powers, chances are the first time you had a fight, you'd kill somebody, you know, you know, or you'd land too hard and cause an earthquake or God knows what. And then, you know, you're 15 years old and you're trying to deal with this. And I had done a story for, I think it was an Amazing Spider-Man family a few years back called The Punch. Yes. And we refer to that in this issue. Although you don't have to have read that story. And I think Danny said that when we collect this all together, we're going to include The Punch in the trade paperback so people can go back and read that. But that was just the idea. He goes to stop a robbery in a grocery store, you know, and one punch and this guy goes flying through the air. He ends up, you know, cracking ribs and breaking an arm and a leg. And Peter's horrified. So now he's like, well, what do I do? You know, I don't know how to adjust this thing. It's all new to him. And, you know, I think the truth is if this, all this stuff existed in the real world, superheroes would be killing people left and right all the time. because how do you adjust that level of power so that when you're fighting, you know, the juggernaut, it's one thing, but when you're stopping some guy robbing a grocery store, how do you adjust your physical, do you know how to adjust your own physical strength? You know, how do you do that?
It's a fascinating concept. And again, yeah, not one that's often explored.
Yeah, yeah.
So one other question I had about Shadow the Goblin is that, so did you go back and, I guess, read Howard's story for the original Proto-Goblin Legacy?
Yeah, oh, I had to know who the hell he was, yeah.
So I'm a curious question I had, just because I really liked that original story, but what I really liked about it, the Proto-Goblin, he's interesting, but really what I liked about it was more the juxtaposition of Arthur and George Stacy. Are we going to see any of those two men in this story, given how important they were for that original story?
Well, we will see George Stacy, but only in the context of the family tragedy that's going on right now. Okay. You know, there's just so much stuff you can fit into a four-issue miniseries. I feel like Gwen and Captain Stacy got a little bit of a short shrift in this. I'm using them and we see them every issue, but you know, if I had more room and more space and more time, but you're juggling Peter and Aunt May and the whole Osborne family thing and the Proto-Goblin and Gwen and Captain Stacy, there's just so much you can fit in. You know, that's what we're talking about, the limitations of the form. You know, we get a 30-page first issue, and then it's three 20-page issues. And I was saying this on social media a few weeks ago. It doesn't sound like a lot, but the difference between a 22-page story and a 20-page story is huge. Those extra two pages really give you time to breathe. And I was just, you know, working on the last issue of Shadow of the Green Goblin. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I have so much that I want to get in here. How am I going to get it all into this, you know, final 20 pages? Well, I worked it out. But if it was a 5-issue series, you know, they used to be like Ben Reilly was a 5-issue series. Now they've cut them down to 4 issues. Mm-hmm. And then 3 of them are 20 pages. So it really, you have to be very careful, very judicious about your choices and what's going to get included and what's not. And sometimes things that you really want to put in just can't make it. And maybe if I'd had time, I would have used, certainly, and it just the very fact that Gwen's mom is sick, well, then Stacy's brother probably, you know, could have shown up. But there was no room to widen that out anymore. And okay, honestly, I hadn't really thought about using him. But if I'd had more space, it's possible I would have come across that.
Now, if I jump back for a second to Spider-Man: The Lost Hunt. So
okay,
you have this success with Ben Reilly Spider-Man with working with Danny. Where and how does what ends up being The Lost Hunt come out? Because it's interesting, because it is a kind of a flip book to, we have Ben's story. Ben's there. Peter's off in Portland. So now we check in Portland, which is, again, a very unique slice of time. So how early in the process did you guys start talking about doing another book, and how quickly did it become a Powerless Peter book?
Well, what happened was, you know, Danny and I had a great time working on Ben Reilly. Marvel was happy with it, so immediately wanted to do another one with me. And you know, a lot of times the basic decisions don't come from me; they come from up above. So what I got through the grapevine was, and I think it was because at that point, the Kraven movie was coming out fairly soon. It got delayed after that. We want to do something that relates to Kraven. And honestly, my first response was, oh, you know? Oh, man, we've been to that well. How many times can we go to that well, you know? But I'd had this character brewing in my head for a couple of years, this character who evolved into Asia Arisha, who's a main character in The Lost Hunt, because I was curious about that gap. How does this refugee from Tsarist Russia comes to New York with his family? How does he end up being the guy in the jungle? What's the link? Where did he learn to be this thing that he became, this Kraven the Hunter? And I evolved this story, you know, and also the idea that this, you know, essentially this white guy is appropriating and corrupting this African culture, you know? And the character of Asia Arisha started growing in my head, and I just fell in love with her. And she, for me, although there are many other things going on in the story, she was one of the really important reasons why I was excited to tell that story. And she's a character I would really, really like to revisit. And then, so we're good. I thought it'd be really, we talked, it would be fun to do this mirror of like, all right, Ben, this is going on with Ben now. What's going on with Peter now? And again, Danny knows more about this stuff than I do. So he sends me a bunch of stuff, and I realize I know they went to Portland. I had completely missed the whole bit where he lost his powers. And, you know, all the bells go off in my head. This is perfect because Peter without his powers. First of all, I've always said that Spider-Man mask on or mask off, there is no Spider-Man. It's Peter Parker. You know, he may show different aspects of his personality when he's Spidey, you know, but it's always stories about Peter Parker. There's this. It's not like I'm Batman and then who's Bruce Wayne, you know? It's mm-hmm. like I'm Peter Parker and that's it. And Peter Parker without the powers is the opportunity to address the question, you know, what makes the hero? Is he a hero because he can stick to walls and shoot webs and punch people in the face really hard? Or is he a hero because of who Peter Parker is? And so opening that door was great. Plus, it's Peter and Mary Jane. I love the Peter Mary Jane relationship, and she's pregnant and they're married, and they didn't say, oh, don't mention the marriage or anything, which would have been insane because you can't, how do you not mention the marriage when she's like massively pregnant, you know? And so I got a chance to write them, dug up that old character Gregor and brought him a little deeper into the mythology and explained his connection to Kraven in a much deeper way. And Asia Arisha, we had so many wonderful pieces in that story. And so what started out as me going, oh, do we have to go back to that well, turned into a story that I was really, really excited to write. And that brings me to something that I always like to say to my when I'm working with my story clients or with my classes, you know, you always have to be open. Yeah. You know, we get locked into, no, I want to do this. I don't want to do that. Well, if you're going to have a career as out here in the trenches as a freelancer, the operative word is yes. And your job is to find the thing that excites you. So if they come to you and say, let's go back to the Kraven well. And yeah, my first reaction might be, well, what can I find in this story that's going to excite me? And then you never know, the thing that you were resistant to in the first place can turn into one of the favorite gigs you ever had. It's happened to me in animation as well. I've written a bunch of these animated movies for DC, and you know, I'm waiting for the next one that's going to come along, and we have a new one for you. And they call me up, and I'm not going to get into what this may have been or not been. And my first response is, oh, that's the character you want to do. You know, I thought I was going to do another Batman one, but they want to do this one. It's like, and so the first reaction might be a little bit of disappointment, but then I start to dig. And I start to dig and I go, oh, my gosh, there's so much to work with here. And you can do this and you can do that. And suddenly that thing that I'm resisting becomes something that I'm passionate about. So it's really important to say yes. And, you know, unless you're being asked to do something that, A, is so far outside your wheelhouse that you know you cannot do it. And even then, it's always good to maybe take a shot and give it a try. You know, one of the animated shows that I worked for about, I guess it must be 5 years ago now or six, was a show called Be Cool Scooby-Doo. Completely different than anything I'd ever done in animation, you know? So far outside my wheelhouse in the tone, in the attitude, and everything that went into writing an episode. But I didn't say, oh, no, this isn't in my wheelhouse. I said, yes, I ended up writing, I think, five episodes working with some wonderful people on the show. And it was really different. And it was actually a lot harder for me because it was outside my wheelhouse. It sounds like it's just Scooby-Doo. It's funny, right? Not easy. Very difficult work. but it helped me, and I learned and I grew through the experience of working on that show. And it was a lot of fun. It was like going to Scooby-Doo college, you know? And the funny thing was, right around the same time, I get a call from Keith Giffen saying DC wants us to do this book, Scooby Apocalypse. And I'm like, what is going on here? All of a sudden, everywhere I look, there's Scooby-Doo in my life, you know? And that too. What are you talking about, Keith? Scooby, what? You know, but I always said I'd work with Keith on anything. You know, if Keith called me up and said, let's do Millie the Model, I'm there. So I was, you know, so all right, Scooby, that sounds really dumb to me, but okay, it's working with you. Let's go. And of course, we ended up doing that for 3 years, and I had a blast working on that book, and I fell in love with those characters. Someone else might have just said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. It really, really pays to say yes. You know, if they're asking you, you know, something that's morally repulsive, like we want to do a comic book celebrating Adolf Hitler, then yeah, you say no. But that hasn't come up yet.
You know? Thank goodness.
Thank goodness, you know. But, you know, it's very rare that something's going to come up that you're going to find morally reprehensible. And usually what happens is you'll say yes, and you will stretch muscles that you didn't stretch before, and you'll learn and grow. And you know what? If you try it and you fail, there's another gig coming up. Don't worry. And you learn something from that failure. Mm-hmm. So even the failure works those muscles.
To that end, so I'm curious how Magneto came about, because it does feel not what we would normally expect from JMD. Like this does, I mean, right. That being said, the actual material feels exactly what you would give us, like when you actually read it. But on the face of it, I was like, oh, Magneto in a very specific time period. Obviously, like I'm imagining that maybe they were trying to time it with X-Men 97, knowing that Magneto was going to be rocking the M, you know, in the return to the
right. Actually, would have been really good to have them come out at the same time, wouldn't it? Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they knew that back then, but maybe they did.
I know X-Men 97 kept getting pushed back, so I would imagine that maybe that was part of it. But like when they called you, what was that conversation like?
Oh, the editor, a really great guy named Mark Basso, and I think I had done something else for him before that. I think I did. And he knew, he said, look, I know that you're really into exploring the villains, getting into their heads. And we want to do this Magneto. I know everybody calls him Magneto. I call him Magneto because it just makes more sense to me. I don't see a long E in that name. I know I'm alone in this, but you can call him Magneto. I'll call him Magneto.
Okay.
Wasn't that a Cole Porter song? You say Magneto, I say Magneto. Yeah. Anyway, so, so he said, we want to do this Magneto thing, and we want to set it in the time when he was the head of the Xavier School. So first alarm bell goes off in my head. I don't know anything about that or about those characters. Nothing. You know, I have only the vaguest awareness of them, that they, you know, I know that they existed. I think I did one story where the New Mutants guest starred for like, you know, half an issue of Defenders 100 years ago. But I never really, got into, knew or understood those characters. But he also talked about that they want to then use that as a lens to go back to those early days of Magneto. So when I first got into Marvel, when I was in the eighth grade, this is back in the 60s, I loved those early X-Men stories. You know, you read them now, you know, out of context of the times, and some of them don't even particularly make sense when you read them, you know, but they still look great and they're a lot of fun. But I loved the early X-Men stuff. So for me, the opportunity to go back and look at those early X-Men stories with a different lens was really exciting. You know, that's the fun of this job. There's always a 10-year-old in my head that I can say, remember those X-Men comics you loved? We're going to write those characters. Oh, God. And, you know, it gets you really excited. And so, you know, and then you read those stories, and Magneto is as one-dimensional a villain as you could find anywhere. You know, he might as well have a big, long mustache to twirl and go, yeah, you know. So the idea was, okay, so we know what a complex character he is. He may be the most complex character in the Marvel Universe. So many contradictions, so much duality in his soul. A duality doesn't even cover it, you know. So how do you square that guy with that guy? And that opened the door on the story to me. And that's what fascinated me more than anything. And in the course of that, I came up with this new character, Irae, who was connected to Magneto. If you read the story, you know how she's connected to him. And again, it's, you know, I think it's important to introduce new elements to these stories. You know, you used the word nostalgia before. And I didn't hate that you said it, but everyone refers to them as nostalgia stories. And if that's all it is, then it's not worth doing. If you just want to give people a shot of nostalgia, then just let them rewatch the old cartoons or reread the old comics. You always want to bring something new to these stories. You want to explore these characters in a new way. And that Magneto thing really allowed me, and I've never written him before. Or if I did, maybe he was in a panel of some story or something, but I never had a chance to write this character and then to go back and look and see what was really going on in his head while the world viewed him as this one-dimensional, crazy mutant villain. So that was really fun. And then the other challenge was to read a lot of New Mutants comics and figure out who these characters were and find a door into those characters, which I was able to do. And that was fun as well, because again, something new. A part of me would be like, I would just like to write about Magneto. Could we leave the other characters out? But I didn't have that choice. So I had to step out of my comfort zone and dig in and see what was there. And it ended up, again, I loved working on that project. It was a lot of fun. I would love to return to those characters. I would love to bring Irae back in some form, you know. Maybe I can do an Asia Orisha Irae team up somewhere. So yeah, it was a really fun project. I had a great time with it.
It did feel like you had kind of the perfect artist you could have on a book that heavily involves the New Mutants and even like some of the flashbacks to the younger X-Men. Because Todd Nock, I don't know if anyone does younger heroes better than him right now. Like,
he loves those characters. He loves the X-Men. He's another one. Like, he knows more than I do. I think he might have known more than the editor does. You know, he's so immersed in those characters and that era. And he did such a way. He's a wonderful, inventive, creative storyteller. Always adding little touches here and there, and very dynamic, very emotional, great action. It was really, I had never worked with him before, so it was a real pleasure to work with him on that project.
It did feel like, thinking about it now, and looking at the New Mutants and the New Mutants who are involved in this story, it kind of makes sense, and at least from a reader perspective, that Rain felt like the one that you really clicked with the most, in terms of really wanting to kind of explore.
Yes.
Her, and I don't think that's a surprise when I really think about the character. What was it about Rain that really spoke to you?
Well, on one simple level, it's just that, you know, I wrote X-Factor for a while back in the 90s, a short run.
Right.
And she was the character I hooked onto back then. I don't know why, but there was something in her that I responded to. And so coming into this story, she was the one I already knew. It was like, oh, I remember you. Remember we used to hang out back in the 90s? You know? and you know, it's a funny thing. Something happens, kind of what I was saying about Aunt May, and you intuitively, something happens in your unconscious, and you just click, and you understand a character. And I just clicked with her, and I understood her, and I understood what she was feeling. And she kind of led me through that part of the story. And that's what you hope for. You want your characters to come alive, to have lives of their own, to do things that you don't expect, to lead you on, to offer you insights. I want to be surprised when I'm writing. And if I'm surprised, and that happens a lot, I get, I didn't know that. Really? What? How did that happen? And if I'm surprised, then I know the readers will be surprised as well. Because if you can fool me, and I'm the guy that's allegedly in control of this thing, and surprise me, then we have something good going on.
Along that line, like which of the New Mutants did you find did surprise you the most?
It's a good question. Let me think. I got to put my mind back there. I'm drawing a blank. That's awful. I guess they didn't surprise me at all. No, I enjoyed the whole team dynamic, and I'd have to look at the story again to really remind myself. I don't remember, and I know I did click with them. The more I was writing them, the more I kind of got into it. I think Roberto was the one with the chip on his shoulder, right? Sunspot? Yeah. I think I clicked with that because I clicked with his attitude. Oh, and the other one who I loved, how could I forget? Warlock. Mm-hmm. Never written that character. I loved the kind of craziness and the absurdity. It kind of clicked with my JLI brain, you know. He's a great character. He brings a lot of humor to the stories, and yet really, really interesting and odd. And you know, it's like someone said, "Hey, you want to do a Warlock series?" I would do a Warlock series in a heartbeat, because it was really, really a fun. You know, thank you for asking that question. It took me a minute to retrieve that information from the data bank, but yeah. Warlock, I really, really loved. Warlock is a great character. And how to draw that? How the hell does anyone draw that thing? It's such a complex design, and yet they do it, and they do it brilliantly.
And again, you having Todd Mock was, again, just something about the way you wrote the characters and wrote them as kids, and mm-hmm. the fact that Todd actually knows how to draw them as kids, I thought made the story a lot more impactful. Like the idea that, because I think when you read the originals, they don't always look as young. And so the idea that Magneto is their headmaster is almost lost a little bit in translation, because they don't necessarily look like they need him. Whereas here, they feel like children. Like they feel like they actually do need this guy leading them. And so which actually makes the story a little harder when he's kind of, you know, against them, or you know, he's being manipulated against them. So it makes it more impactful as a result.
Yeah. I think sometimes we forget when we're reading stories about these teen sidekicks, you know, we sort of project more of an adult quality onto them, and we forget, you know. Even I wrote an animated movie called Batman versus Robin a few years back, and a lot of it had to do with Bruce's relationship with Damian. And I read the comics, and in my head, even though I know he's supposed to be younger, he plays older. Mm-hmm. And his voice in my head is older. And even when I'm writing the script for the movie, it's playing older in my head. And then the movie's there in front of me, and I'm watching it, and he starts to talk, and he's a kid. And it was actually shocking to me for a second, you know? Oh, yeah, he's really young. And, oh, God, he's having a fight with Batman. Batman, what are you doing? You're punching this 10-year-old kid, you know? So it's important to remember how young these characters are. Now, obviously, the way they get around it with Damien is that he was raised by Ra's al Ghul, and he's a master assassin, and he's this, and he's that. But the dichotomy and the interesting thing is, he's still a kid, you know? So that's what makes him interesting.
Absolutely. So I only have a few minutes left, and unfortunately I left the big nugget that I really wanted to talk to the end, so I apologize. But I'm curious about, if I go back to the 90s, both kind of just pre-Clone Saga and also post-Clone Saga, you used Chameleon in two different kind of major ways. I'm curious, what is it about Chameleon that really speaks to you? Because you're the first one who, it feels like, really played with his sense of identity and self, and who is this person who can become other people, and what would that do to someone? And so I'm curious, what led you to kind of go that way with Chameleon? Because now it seems so natural, but at the time, I mean, I was not reading necessarily at the time. I was maybe too young to get it, but I'm curious what the interactions were at the time with editors, and if anyone pushed back about really kind of peeling this extra layer, adding this extra layer to Chameleon.
No one pushed back, because I think, you know, if you're hiring me, you know that peeling layers is just what's going to happen for good or ill. You know, I'm not saying, you know, it may not always work, but that's what I try to do. And, you know, the first thing that hooked me into Chameleon was the fact that he had this connection to Kraven. And so I was the one that came up with the idea that he was actually Kraven's illegitimate half brother, and that he had been abused by Kraven, you know, by his older brother for years, and was basically enthralled to him. He worshipped him. He hated him. And what does that do to somebody? And then, the other thing is we talked about themes earlier. Well, one of the major themes in a lot of my stories is basically the search for self. You know, who am I? Who am I in the deeply personal psychological sense? Who am I in the spiritual sense? Who am I in the cosmic sense? And you know, some people really can't find their own center, or in order to protect themselves, we put on, that's the whole superhero thing, right? Put on a mask, create another persona. And here's this guy who can only be comfortable in his own skin when he's creating another persona. I think there's so much to explore that I probably just scratched the surface with that character, you know? So he was a really, really interesting one. And I also like the story where Mary Jane beat the hell out of him with a baseball bat too.
Absolutely.
It was like, when Peter's like, you just beat up the Chameleon? You know?
It's interesting. I feel like, so I've always felt this way about the post-Clone Saga pre-relaunch period is criminally under-discussed, undervalued, and I've loved that period. That's, for me, when I really became a Spider-Man fan was that period. Like, I had read some of the kind of the Clone Saga stuff, but really me picking up issues on a regular basis was in that kind of the interesting period. And so you are writing Spectacular Spider-Man during that time, and you really thread this fascinating needle between hilarious and very serious, which you've always done to a degree, but sometimes right. It was like, you know, you would have the Child Within and then you immediately have, you know, a Frogman issue right after, right? Like
right.
You have the moment of seriousness and then you would, you know, have something that was ludicrous. But it felt like with those Spectacular issues, you were doing kind of both in the, at the same time.
And oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
And you had a lot of, like, you had the serious subplots, you had everything with the Jack-o'-lantern and kind of the specter of him on the periphery. You have the Legion of Losers. You have a lot of fun stuff, but then you're also going to have the seriousness of the Chameleon. And then you kind of turn it on its head because he does get beaten up by MJ at the end, which is almost laughable considering everything that the comic was leading up to it at that point. So I'm curious if you can remember what you felt 25 years ago. What was it about trying to thread that needle differently and try to have each issue explore kind of both aspects of your writing?
See, now I'm going to have to be Stan Lee and just make up an answer because I don't remember. Well, you know, I worked it all out perfectly in my head before I started. No, I was just, you know, you write intuitively. And you know, probably started with that Legion of Losers story. And then I got fascinated with was it the Grizzly and the Gibbon? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there have been... God bless them, and I don't mean to knock whoever came up with them. They were kind of dumb characters, you know? But they also kind of resonated with me in the same way that a lot of our JLI characters resonated, you know? Mm-hmm. They're goofy, but they're still real people in these goofy costumes. So who are these guys, and what are they thinking? And the whole plot line with Grizzly and the Gibbon trying to become kind of Batman and Robin, you know? I just had a lot of fun with it. And as I learned, you know, in all the work I did with Keith, The comical characters in some ways become even more real because, you know, and that's why I always say that Spider-Man in a lot of ways is the main Marvel character that probably could have fit in the JLI because he's got such a good sense of humor. You know, humor is a doorway into our hearts and minds and souls. You know, humor is just part of our lives, even in the darkest, especially in the darkest times. So here, this is a profound answer, considering I don't know the answer. So to, you know, to blend all those things together and to be able to move through those different feelings. And really, if you want to get even deeper, you know, read Dickens, read Dostoevsky. It's like very, very big, epic, serious stories, but there's so much humor woven through it. I mean, Dickens can go really, really deep and really, really dark and then have you laughing, you know, in the next chapter because he brings in some absurd character. So, you know, certain pieces are tone pieces. Like Craven's Last Hunt is very much a tone piece. Mm. You can't really break that story with a laugh.
No.
But, you know, but otherwise it's nice to leaven things with some humor. That's why even like in the first Shadow of the Goblin, Peter, you know, can't get a gig. So he ends up playing at this kid's birthday party and it's kind of pathetic and kind of funny. And then it ends up being a little touching and sweet. But, you know, in an ideal world, you want all those different elements in a story. Mm.
So going back to that Spectacular run, because, again, it is a favorite of mine, an element that I always loved, and I just want to thank you for it, because I think it added a lot of really cool stories for that period before they kind of reset things with the relaunch, was having Norman Osborn by the Bugle, which was always a really cool kind of way to use Norman and kind of transition him away from just being the Goblin into being more of a threat as just Norman Osborn. Because we'd never really seen that before because he had only ever been the Green Goblin. Then when he came back after the Clone Saga, he was the Green Goblin again, and then he was out. And so you got to actually use him as Norman. So I always appreciated that and just want to thank you for all the stories you kind of did with that and him manipulating Peter and, you know, goading Peter into beating him up in Spectacular 250, like that kind of stuff.
Right.
Was really resonant. And it's interesting looking back that although Spectacular wasn't, quote unquote, the flagship Spidey book, everyone took cues from that. Everyone took cues from, you know, you bringing back Norman and what that meant.
Well, let credit where credit's due. It was not my idea to bring back Norman. That was already in the works, I think, when I came onto the book.
Okay.
So I was picking up on something that was already happening. I don't want to take credit for something I didn't do. But I had fun with it. You know, I absolutely had fun with it. Because that, you know, it's kind of the same thing, mask on, mask off, you know, whether he's the Green Goblin or not, he's still, you know, Norman is Norman and he's a devious, he's a devious guy. And the relationship between Norman and Peter is going to be the same, whether they're Spider-Man and the Green Goblin or Peter Parker and Norman Osborn. So that was fun to play with. That was absolutely fun to play with. Although, as for obvious reasons, Harry still remains my favorite Green Goblin.
Well, obviously. a curious thing about the Chameleon, going back for a second, or actually not even the Chameleon, you writing Amazing Spider-Man. One thing, I was recently doing a Book of the Month Club, and we were kind of going through Life Theft, and then after that you have Pursuit and Shrieking. And I had forgotten that Michelinie leaves after, I guess, Life Theft is over, and your first issue is part of Pursuit. So you're just kind of thrown into the thick of it. With
right.
Amazing Spider-Man.
I came in on the final, I think I wrote the final chapter.
You did. And again, yeah. You start adding a lot of these elements of Chameleon and really kind of going into it. What I'm curious about is that, you know, there's a year, I think it's about a year and a half between you stop writing Spectacular and then you come back with Amazing. I'm curious about that gap. Was that you deciding to leave Spectacular and what brought you back to Amazing?
I did. Yeah, I kind of felt like I'd done what I had to do on Spectacular. I mean, that Harry Osborn saga came to a very definitive end, and it felt complete, and I felt complete, and I'm done. And you know, was it really a year and a half between those two things? Wow.
I think it was maybe not quite a year and a half. It was at least a year though.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then you have to factor in the time I'm working on it before the book comes out, you know, all that.
Sure.
What brought me back was two things. One, they asked me, and, you know, we all had a really nice relationship in the Spider office. You know, we have really from editorial with Danny Fingeroth and Eric Fine and all those people and all the other writers. We all got along. We all respected each other. We all had fun together. So there was that. And then there's just kind of what I said earlier about Peter being a real person. And it's sort of like, oh, I think I'm done. Then all of a sudden, well, I kind of miss Peter. I wonder what he's up to. I wonder what, So then you reconnect with the character and off you go. Now, you know, what happened was we ended up in the Clone Saga. So, the first few issues were just like, I'm just writing my stories. And about five or six issues in, suddenly, you know, it's always chapter three or four of a four-part story every month. That was difficult. And that's why I eventually left Amazing. Not because I didn't respect the guys or didn't care for the story, but it was just like, I want to just tell my story. We had a great time. Those Spider-Man writer meetings were some of my, during the Clone Saga, some of my favorite memories of all my years working in comics. Just, we had such good people. We had so much fun. We, you know, have writers' meetings every other week. They'd lock us in a room with Danny, and we'd eat pizza or Chinese food and yell at each other and scream and carry on, all in the most respectful, idiotic way. You know, we just had fun. And so I really loved the creative process of working. It was almost like a writer's room on a TV show, you know? Mm-hmm. What wasn't as much fun was just going home and writing chapter four. Mm-hmm. And then what sometimes happens is, I'm a very spontaneous writer. And as I was saying, you want your story to surprise you. And sometimes, you know, we work out what all the chapters are basically going to be. And I'm writing and suddenly the character rears up and does something unexpected. And I still, one thing I still clearly remember, I was working on one issue. And at the end of it, the female Dr. Octopus reveals to this other character, Seward Trainor, reveals to the audience that she's his daughter. We had never discussed that. In fact, I didn't know she was his daughter until she said it. You know? Tom DeFalco was writing the next chapter, and I did this whole spin at the end of the story. What I didn't know was Tom was already written the plot for his chapter. Oh. And so Tom had to go back and make adjustments to his work, and I had to, I'm sure, grovel and apologize. But Tom is such a great guy, he didn't mind. But, you know, so writing the little chapter in between can be very constricting. Creating the stories as a group was a lot of fun. Writing those, I had more fun, say, writing the Lost Years miniseries, you know, because that stood on its own. Or, you know, Amazing 400, a story that really kind of just stood on its own for 90% of that story. But that's just me. That's just my nature. I'm not a big crossover guy. I've had a few crossovers over the years that I've had fun with. But for the most part, it's like, can I just be left alone to tell my stories my own way, you know?
So I'm going to ask you a very specific question, which you can give me a Stan Lee answer, because I think that's probably what I'm going to get here, but unless you do remember it.
Okay, true believer.
Okay. So one of my favorite issues of Amazing Spider-Man, and it's probably because it was a gift when I was 12, 13 years old. It was Amazing Spider-Man 396. You have it's Back from the Edge, I believe, part 304. You got Spider-Man and you got Daredevil in his black armored costume.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot in there about Daredevil really kind of talking to Peter about how he should, you know, kill Peter because that's basically what he did. Although he's not accepting enough, you know, confirming for Peter that he is still Matt Murdock, but he is kind of telling him what to do. So I've always loved it. I've always found it impactful. Every time I read it, Bagley's art is phenomenal in it. Is there anything you can recall about writing Matt, that specific version of Matt? Because he had gone through, obviously, his own stuff under D.G. Chichester's pen over in Daredevil. And right. But this was my first interaction, my first time ever seeing Daredevil, was your interpretation of this specific version. So I'm curious if there's any memories of this.
And what I'm remembering is that I took over Daredevil right after Dan. Again, a short run. I was maybe on it for 8 issues or 9 issues or something. Mm-hmm. It's an identity thing again. I'm fascinated with the theme of identity, who we are versus who we think we are, the masks we wear, you know? And so Matt had this thing where he had, quote, buried Matt Murdock, you know, fooled himself, because you can't bury yourself, fooled himself into believing he'd really done something positive for his own psyche. And so just to play with that idea, and that's what Peter was going through at the time. I think that was the I Am the Spider phase, right? He had been so traumatized by Aunt May's stroke and all these other things, you know, the parent fake out, all these things that had gone on, that he was like, Peter Parker's too vulnerable. And that's something I think that we all do at some point in our life. We find something else to retreat into to protect ourselves. So when you've got a costume and another identity to start with, then you go hide in that identity. That's what Matt did. That's what Peter did. So it was, my memory is that, you know, as vague as it is, that knowing the themes that fascinate me, that's probably what brought the meat to that story.
There was one other element that I remember from that issue, actually two, is that it was the first time we'd seen Vulture since Life Theft, which wasn't that long. It was only a few months, but you're the first one who really explored what the young Vulture was going to be like after he had the artificial life kind of in through his veins, which was interesting. But also, I think you probably wrote my favorite version of the Owl. Which was, you know, I would say very unlike most versions of the Owl, but he was going through his own kind of who am I phase. And so for me, it's funny because we gravitate to the things we read when we're young. We kind of clamp right. down on those. So whenever I read the Owl, I'm like, well, it's not JMD's Owl. Because that's not the one I loved and kind of grew up with, so to speak.
Well, and that was fun too, because, you know, the Owl was like, and I read Daredevil as a kid. I read all those early Daredevil stories. I remember the Owl. But then you have to write that character.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, well, who is he? Why does he do what he do? What he does? You know, you got to dig in a little bit and figure that out. You know, we take so much for granted. Oh yeah, he got powers. He put on a costume and he runs around and he's a bad guy and he robs banks or he wants to take over the world or whatever. But as I often say to my writing students, you know, what's the big why? Why do they do what they do? So I don't really honestly remember much of what I did with the Owl. I remember that I had fun doing it, and I can see Bagley's art in front of my head as we're saying this. You know, he did a really, really great Owl. But, you know, you want to figure the character out a little bit. And what you hope in any story is that you can bring a little something to the character that wasn't there before, even if it's a small thing, some aspect of who they are that hasn't been explored before, you know, because it makes it interesting for me. And hopefully it makes it interesting for the audience. But that's, you know, that's what I'm interested in. Okay, you have a cool costume, and you do this, that, and the other thing, you have these powers. But what's going on in your head? What's going on in your heart? That's what interests me.
I do think it was probably the first time anyone asked that question of the Owl. Because I think he had been used as a blunt instrument, as you kind of mentioned. I don't think a lot of people had wanted to kind of go deeper on that character. And so that's why I really respect your interpretation of the character, because it did feel like, you know, trying to ask that question. And he's kind of asking it of himself. Why am I doing this? Who am I now? And who do I want to be? And obviously it parallels what's going on with Peter and Daredevil
right,
at the same time
right,
as well.
Right, right.
It's anyways, I have always enjoyed it. So it's nice to be able to tell the creator how much it means to me.
Oh, and thank you.
Telling you now,
and now I'm thinking, oh, wow, maybe I should find a way to get the Owl into the next Spidey thing I do. Oh, that, you know. So if he shows up in my next miniseries, you can thank yourself for that.
Awesome. All right. Well, JM, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with me today about.
Happy to do it. I want to plug one thing before we go.
Yes, please do.
Because coming up, we're hoping to launch somewhere in mid-May. For those of you who followed my Kickstarter last year, a little before that, we did something called the Demultiverse, which was four new series written by me with four wonderful artists, each one a different genre, different style, different tone. We launched four number ones at once, and it was a great success. And we took a little survey at the end of the Kickstarter. Well, which of these books do you want to have continue? And thinking they'd pick one and we would complete the miniseries. And what we got back from the people that supported the Kickstarter was they want to see more of all four. So what we have launching this spring is the second issues of all four stories. And that will be coming up on Kickstarter, hopefully in May. It might, you know, the latest in June. And frankly, I wouldn't mind coming back to talk when the Kickstarter launches, because, you know, what I learned the first time I did it is a Kickstarter is a lot of work and you really have to bang the drum and raise awareness for it. But it was the Demultiverse is one of the most fun, challenging things I've done in my entire career. Just, you know, to launch four new books at the same time. Mm-hmm. It was really, really a treat. And now, you know, the frustration with number ones is, you know where it can go. You know where these characters are going to go, where the story is going to evolve. But this is just the introduction. So now with the second issues, we get to move forward. We get to deepen the characters, deepen the mythologies, deepen the stories. So we'll see the second installments of all four of them coming soon to you, wherever you are.
I mean, you're always welcome back. You don't have to wait 2 years. If you want to come back in a couple months, let's do it.
We might. Yeah, absolutely. You know, maybe let's get in touch in early in May and I'll have a better sense of when we're launching and then we can figure something out.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time today.
And, my pleasure.
No, this has been a real treat. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.